Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of the region on this Friday, December 20, 2024. U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan calls for a ceasefire in the country.
So we've got to lock in those humanitarian gains that are saving lives. But ultimately, we've got to move towards a ceasefire, even a temporary ceasefire from the parties to give some relief to the horrific conditions that millions of Sudanese people are facing.
And health workers in Jonglei State say many pregnant women test positive for HIV/AIDS.
We have 0.8 prevalence of HIV, including the neo-infant and also the hurdle, and also we have the one for the less number for ALC.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus on this Friday, December 19, 2024. Upper Nile State Ministry of Health says Malakal is leading in HIV case numbers in the state. An official from the ministry says HIV prevalence in the state is at 0.8%, but lack of condoms and awareness of the virus led to increase in numbers. Mamer Abraham Court reports from Malakal on this Friday, December 20, 2024.
Bini Kwajen, Director for Monitoring and Evaluation in Upper Nile State's Ministry of Health, says an awareness campaign last week in Malakal found new HIV/AIDS cases.
We have 0.8 prevalence of HIV, including the neo-infant and also the hurdle, and also we have the one for the less number for ALC. So actually, the leading count is now is Malakal headquarters, followed by Maban, followed by Rang. My department has a lot of challenge.
The Upper Nile State's Ministry of Health says Malakal has recorded the highest number of HIV cases in the state this year compared with last year. According to the data from the Upper Nile State's Ministry of Health, 37 male and 31 female two-month-old babies were exposed to the virus in Malakal and were on cotrimoxazole, a drug that treats certain bacterial infections such as pneumonia, bronchitis, and infections of the urinary tract, ears, and intestines. He says state-wise, 38 male and 80 female infants were found to be exposed to HIV. Kwajen says condom use is still a challenge in Malakal because of ignorance.
For the issue of the condom, I think we are lacking because the condom that they have distributed within the Malakal, there are 190. It's not 190 characters. Those small box. The whole is said they are not using condom.
Joseph Obonyo, director of the HIV/AIDS Commission in Upper Nile State, says the commission carried out an education campaign in Malakal Town and displaced persons camps last week after securing funding from the World Food Program. He says remote counties of the state are still waiting for HIV awareness programs.
We can't do anything as the government because mostly we rely on the partners. And partners, you know, sometimes getting the fund from them for their kind of activities, I think, become very hard at this particular time. So we just confine ourselves here within Malakal.
Galwag Red, a resident of Malakal, says young men and women are at risk of HIV infection.
It can expose the future of youth because young youth are affected. Youths are the backbone of the country. They are the leader of tomorrow. When they are affected, which means the future of the country is affected.
UNAIDS says the major challenges of HIV prevention in South Sudan are poverty, insecurity, lack of awareness, stigma and discrimination, displacement and disruption of health system. For VOA News, I am Amir Abraham Kwod, reporting from Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal.
Still on health issues, authorities in South Sudan's Jonglei State say antenatal care unit is finding high numbers of HIV-positive pregnant mothers in Bor. Atong Ajak, a nurse at Bor State Hospital, says she registers new cases each day. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Bor.
Women are shutting under mango trees at Bor State Hospital as they wait for antenatal care services. The services include a mandatory HIV test, and some women say they are anxious and curious as they wait for their turn to see a doctor. Achan Mabior is one of them.
My heart was pumping faster when I came here. I was worried that HIV may be found in my blood because you can't trust men these days. Recently, Jongole was found to be one of the leading states in South Sudan with a high number of infections. That makes a lot of women like me very worried.
Achan says she was relieved after her test was negative. Awoy Malek says HIV testing is a routine practice for her family because her husband has another wife.
Regular testing is how we are managing. When my co-wife stops her child from breastfeeding and gets ready for another pregnancy, she goes for testing with our husband. The same as me. He is staying on that side of Upper Nile, and when he comes, we also go for testing. But if I am still breastfeeding, he goes for testing with the other wife.
As in other parts of South Sudan, some residents in Jonglei State practice polygamy. Atong Ajak works as a nurse at an antenatal facility. She says each day she registers at least one case of pregnant woman testing positive for HIV and encourages them to seek voluntary counseling and testing.
When I'm doing tests, I can get one a day or two a day. Yeah, when I test the mother and I found positive, I make referral form from here to BCT and call the husband for further management. We call the husband, we test the husband. When the husband also is positive, and then we make enrollment also, and they continue with their drugs.
Ajak March is the tuberculosis and HIV coordinator in Jonglei State. He says over 800 mothers tested positive for HIV in Jonglei State this year.
Actually, it is compulsory. The government of South Sudan say all the mothers who are seeking for the ALC service must be tested. Not them alone, should be escorted by their husband together so that they will come and know their status. You can't not trust somebody by physical experience, by their health. Just you trust him when you know, when you go for the testing.
He says since 2011, over 32,000 people have been living with HIV in Jonglei State. Health experts, including UNAIDS officials, say a lack of resources, widespread stigma, and insecurity undermines effort to fight HIV across South Sudan and Jonglei State in particular. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayer, reporting from Bor.
From Bor, we go to the rest of Africa, where Africa's mining sector is witnessing a surge in legal disputes in the Sahel and Central Africa as mining companies face increasing scrutiny in the countries in which they operate. The disputes stem from tax and custom audits and a lack of expertise in managing finance, attribution, and change in legislations in some countries. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA from Nairobi.
In a statement Wednesday, officials with the Barrick Gold Corporation said its operating entities in Mali submitted a request for arbitration to the International Centre for the Settlement of Investment Disputes, ICSID, to address the disagreement with the Mali government regarding the Loulo-Gounkoto complex. Barrick, the world's second largest gold miner, and the Mali military government have been in a dispute over new mining rules since 2023. The new rules seek to give the state and local private investors a 35% interest in mining projects, up from 20%. The International Arbitration, or ICSID, registered cases in six sub-Saharan countries this year: Angola, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, Senegal, South Sudan, and Tanzania. Of the cases filed by investors and countries, 28% were in the oil, gas and mining sectors, the highest. Beverly Ocheng is a senior analyst with Control Risks, a firm specializing in political, security and integrity risks. She says inward-looking countries and mineral rights are causing authorities to clash with mining firms.
Across the continent, there has been this bigger drive towards resource nationalism, whereby countries feel that because they are the biggest stakeholders of those resources, whether it's gold, whether it's zinc, it's uranium, that they ought to put in legislation or update the legislation to make sure that the governments are earning a lot more. So it hasn't quite led to disputes in other countries in the way it's publicly played out with Mali, but it is bound to raise some concerns about how those transitions happen.
Mining experts argue that political instability, particularly in countries like Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, changes in mining laws and alliances have affected companies that have been mining in those countries for decades. Some countries have shut down mining sites because of alleged environmental damage and failure to remit taxes to the government. Disputes between companies and states arise from changes in government, insecurity, political instability, tax evasion, tribal authority, and environmental and social issues. Paul Ogendi teaches law at the University of Nairobi. He says strong governance and rule of law are crucial for effective dispute resolution and preventing conflict and suffering.
We need to have the governance structures operating so that the judiciary and other arbitration or other dispute resolution mechanisms can operate. If we do not have a strong governance structure and institutions particularly working under the rule of law, it would be a waste of time to go to court or any forum to arbitrate or resolve your dispute, because the players will ignore it and continue destabilizing the regions. And this will continue to spur conflict and the suffering of the people.
Geopolitical tensions are also influencing some African countries' decision to deny or revoke licenses of some companies and give them to their newfound friends like China and Russia. Ocheng says the African countries' new built alliances are not threatening traditional mining firms, but regulatory measures are becoming challenging for them.
It's not necessarily the biggest threat for Western operators. For Western operators, it's just mostly an issue of compliance and ensuring that they have an understanding of how these governments, various governments, can have various factors of compliance that they need to adhere to. But the emergence of new players is definitely going to change that environment and is going to be seen either as an opportunity or a threat, depending on who is assessing it.
The ICSID says 88 proceedings were concluded in 2024. Of these, 71% were settled by the tribunal and 29% were settled or proceedings discontinued. This year, Tanzania reached an agreement with the Canadian company Montero Mining and Exploration Limited over a licensing dispute and agreed to pay $27 million. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan calls for help. Find out why after the break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what skill would you most like to master?
I would love to learn how to use my hands. That is craft work. Making the baskets and doing more of the clay at work.
So I think I will go technology any day, anytime. So mastering what I do already, which is practically technology, which is software development, applications development, analysis and data mining.
I would love to play the organ. I love it. I love the sound. I would want to have it at home to play to my family.
Now many people don't like to be teachers. So for me, I'm willing to be.
I appreciate people that I can sing because I can't sing myself and I don't have a very good voice. So I will go for singing.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Pirellio, says more food and medicine is reaching malnourished families in places like Zamzam Camp or Kadikli in southern Kordofan. He says more needs to be done towards a ceasefire to give some relief to the horrific conditions that millions of Sudanese people are facing. VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashar interviewed Tom Pirellio in New York.
Well, one of the things that Secretary Blinken made clear today at the United Nations is that we're going to use every second we've got, and we've got some momentum. We're in the fifth straight month of breaking the largest humanitarian embargo in the world, but we have so much more to do. We've seen four times more food and medicine moving into Sudan than we saw just a few months ago, and each one of those is food and medicine reaching a mother or a child that's been malnourished for months in places like Zamzam Camp or Kadugli in South Kordofan. We're getting the convoys moving, including the first convoy into parts of southern Khartoum since the war began almost 2 years ago. So we've got to lock in those humanitarian gains that are saving lives. But ultimately, we've got to move towards a ceasefire, even a temporary ceasefire from the parties to give some relief to the horrific conditions that millions of Sudanese people are facing.
And how do you hope to move towards that temporary ceasefire? Might you convene another meeting of the ALPS before January 20th?
Well, I just came yesterday from Mauritania, where we were meeting with the African Union, the United Nations, the Arab League, and others about how we can move towards expanding both local and national ceasefire efforts. It was a big statement for Secretary Blinken to sit at the council today in the UN. And you heard from the Algerians and the other African leaders this idea that we've got to give more urgency to this ceasefire. They were commending the courage of Sudanese women who time and time again have called on the world to pay more attention to these horrific atrocities. And the fact is, this famine and this war was a war of choice by men who are willing to let the Sudanese people suffer. And those same men can help bring it to an end if we can get the regional actors in Africa and in the Gulf to align on an effort to put a pause in the fighting and restore the civilian transition.
So would you say the two generals are the biggest obstacle to peace? Is this just about their egos, or does it go deeper?
Well, certainly it was a big part of what started this war. But really, you have to go back a few steps and remember it was Generals Hemeti and Burhan joining forces to overthrow the civilian transition that had inspired the world in 2019. And there are many forces behind both of them that want to prevent the people of Sudan from having the power over their future. And we continue to see that with extremist groups and others who want to profit from this war, whether it's groups like the National Congress Party of the former Bashir era that know the people wouldn't support them having power, and they're using this war to come back to power. We see some of the tribal leaders who should be some of the strongest voices for peace, instead of figuring out how to profit off of the famine and off of the war. We see countries that have engaged and are willing to continue to see that suffering of the Sudanese people. But we've also seen neighboring countries show the welcomeness of to accept millions of refugees. We've seen efforts in the region to work with us on these local ceasefire efforts, including some of these humanitarian corridors. So it's important that we not use the level of the crisis as an excuse to do nothing, because when we've engaged, we've been able to make a difference. And I think that's what Secretary Blinken was trying to remind the council today.
So what will it take to get the two generals to the negotiating table?
Well, first of all, I think we'll continue to try to push them to the table. But what we showed with the ALPS efforts in Switzerland on humanitarian access is you don't need a table anymore. We have telephones. We have proximity talks. What we need is the political will. And we appreciate that countries like Saudi Arabia and Egypt and others are continuing to try to support these peace efforts. We think the African Union has a role to play, and the American people. In the same way we've seen Americans show just so much compassion in crisis after crisis around the world, we need folks to see these young people with the Mutual Aid Sudan and elsewhere that are risking their lives to get food and medicine into their communities. They need that support and attention from us. It's also something, quite frankly, that has really strong bipartisan support on Capitol Hill, including from a recent letter this week from both Republican and Democratic senators trying to draw more attention to the crisis in Sudan. So it needs all of us to pay more attention. But most of all, it needs the people with guns and the people supplying guns to all sides in Sudan to put those down and become partners in peace.
So you mentioned, and Secretary Blinken mentioned in the council, that there's a lot of external interference in the war in Sudan. There's credible evidence that the UAE has been fueling the violence and supplying the RSF with arms. So why has the Biden administration been reluctant to really exert significant public pressure on the UAE?
Well, you saw some powerful testimony today at the Security Council about this issue about foreign interference and the role certain countries are playing to fuel this conflict. The Biden administration has really led the way on putting pressure on all of the external actors to stop fueling this war and inviting them to be partners in peace, both ending the famine and trying to end this war. Linda Thomas-Greenfield helped push for an extension of the Darfur arms embargo and also the first sanctions for violating that arms embargo in over 15 years. So we are going to continue with our sanctions and with our diplomacy to raise the costs of those that are fueling this conflict, but also to continue to invite in those who want to be partners for not just peace for the Sudanese people, but how we rebuild Sudan and how we restore that civilian transition. Secretary Blinken announced today an additional $30 million with Congress to support civil society, particularly women and youth who've continued to inspire us in Sudan to help rebuild that political dialogue and that path, the only real path forward, which is a unified civilian front into peace and democracy.
There are reports that the State Department is considering a genocide declaration. Many Sudanese have been targeted based on their ethnicity. Secretary Blinken said today that there's been ethnic cleansing and war crimes, crimes against humanity. Why the reluctance to use the genocide word, and especially when the RSF has elements of the former Janjaweed who committed the 2003 genocide? What's holding the State Department back?
Well, far from reluctance, the State Department's really been leading the way. I mean, as someone who was in Darfur more than 20 years ago when the genocide was happening, when I was out of government a year ago, I was proud that the State Department led the way on declaring the acts of ethnic cleansing that we heard about from the Sultan of the Mausoleum today, called out the crimes against humanity. We'll continue to look at where the facts lead in terms of other designations. But really, it's been a lot of leadership by the Biden administration, as well as bipartisan support on Capitol Hill to call these horrific crimes what they are, to call out the atrocities and the ethnic cleansing, and to get more of our colleagues not just to call it what it is, but to create a price in the way that we've been issuing sanctions, not just on the individuals conducting these horrific atrocities, but on more of the companies that are helping to aid and abet and supply weapons into this conflict. So we need more countries to join with U.S. leadership in that effort, not just to call out the atrocities, but to make sure there's a price.
I know your time is short today. Do you have anything else you want to add?
I think if there's a silver lining in the midst of this horrific crisis, the largest humanitarian crisis in the world, it's one that I think more and more countries are waking up to just what a big crisis it is, not just a humanitarian crisis first and foremost, but also a threat to regional and global security. In an area like Sudan, where bin Laden once spent 7 years building the al-Qaeda network, if we see the kind of failed state we've seen in the region, it could become a black hole pulling down the lives and conditions of tens of millions of people in the region. And instead, what we're seeing, I think, today in the Security Council and elsewhere is more and more countries realizing they need to get involved, not with the toxic supply of weapons or enabling the hate crimes and divisiveness, but instead in being partners in peace. I think Secretary Blinken and Ambassador Thomas-Greenfield have helped lead that effort. We need more partners, and I appreciate that we have a lot of champions on Capitol Hill who are not going to let the world forget about the people of Sudan and their courage and their aspirations to a peaceful and democratic future.
That's U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Pirello, speaking to VOA's UN correspondent Margaret Bashar in New York. Still on Sudan, United Nations Human Rights Chief Volker Turk is calling for an end to the siege of El Fasher in North Darfur, which has resulted in hundreds of civilian deaths and widespread destruction of homes and infrastructure. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A report issued today by the United Nations Human Rights Office describes the devastating impact of the seven-month-long siege of El Fasher in Sudan, with at least 782 civilians killed and more than 1,140 injured. Over the past 7 months, Saif Magango, a spokesperson for Human Rights Chief Turk, says the rapid support forces, Sudanese armed forces, and their allies have turned the city into a battleground from which there is no escape.
There has been regular and intense shelling by the RSF of densely populated residential areas, recurrent airstrikes by the SAF, and artillery shelling by both the SAF and its allied joint forces. Residential neighborhoods, markets, hospitals, and camps hosting internally displaced people have been struck.
The report accuses the warring parties of the indiscriminate use of explosive weapons in populated areas. It says the Zamzam and Abu Shouk camps, which host hundreds of thousands of internally displaced people, have been shelled repeatedly. The report says the RSF has repeatedly attacked Al Saudi Maternity Hospital. Consequently, Magango says Al Saudi, which had been El Fasha's only remaining public hospital capable of providing surgical procedures and sexual and reproductive health services, is no longer functional. This, he says, is particularly tragic as there has been a surge in cases of sexual violence since the siege began.
Attacks on civilians and civilian objects may amount to war crimes. This alarming situation cannot be allowed to continue. All parties to the conflict must refrain from attacks on civilians and civilian objects and respect international law.
Magango says human rights monitors are concerned about a buildup of SAF allied joint forces in the densely populated Zamzam camp. He says there also are concerning reports of increased mobilization of fighters by the parties to the conflict along tribal lines across Darfur. This, he adds, indicates preparations for further hostilities may be underway. The RSF and Sudan National Forces have been battling for control of the country since April 2023. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And it's that time we listen to you on what we do on this show. We start with Peter Gorge, Anyang Majongdul in Block 3 in Bor, who writes, lack of proper survey is the cause of all fire outbreaks in South Sudan. The ministry concerned should survey markets, deploy firefighters to prevent fire outbreaks. Thomas Kuntoch in Fanga County in Jonglo State writes, I'm appealing to the health ministry at the national level to be vigilant about the spread of cholera in South Sudan. All health agencies in South Sudan need to work hand in hand to overcome the outbreak. My condolences goes to families who lost their loved ones in Unity State. Mading Malwa Laluang in Juba writes, in a remote and impoverished nation, the legislative body of the government has embarked on a prolonged four-month vacation, while the brave men and women who serve in the police, national security, and the military forces are tirelessly watching over the streets, enduring harsh conditions without access to basic necessities such as water, food, or medical supplies. This situation is unacceptable and demands immediate attention. That's according to Alwang. Jacob Dior Machuang writes, good evening, South Sudan in Focus. I'm from Juba. The Ministry of Roads and Transport needs to check systems that has been ongoing at the Juba International Airport. Baggage of local and international arrivals are checked manually, and that does not look good. Views expressed in this segment does not represent the views of Voice of America, nor the management of the South Sudan in Focus. That's all we prepared for you this Friday, December 20th, 2024. We now leave you with the song Olulagbe by Wiz Boys. We have been listening to the Wizkids and the song Ojulogbe. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaru, and Engineer Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. For better living.